It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new academic year is underway, and University of Pittsburgh Provost Ann Cudd is entering her second year at the helm of Pitt's academic mission. Ann Cudd joins us now. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a joy to be here.
When you first took on this role, you pledged to prioritize diversity and inclusion at Pitt. How have you done that 1 year into your job?
Yeah, that certainly is an important priority for me. I mean, I see diversity as so important to our educational opportunities and to the environment that we can create for other students, and just to the cause of justice. But so what have we done? Well, first of all, we're continuing a lot of great programs that had been begun by the previous provost and by others at the university. But one of the things that we're doing is we're improving our hiring practices in various ways to eliminate bias, implicit bias in particular, and to help us achieve a larger population of faculty and staff who are from diverse communities. We're also improving the diversity of the student body. And one of the signature initiatives that we embarked on in this last year was really overhauling our financial aid. And this is a program we call Pitt Success. It helps us to bring in more low-income students, so right. We diversify by socioeconomically, but also racially and in other ways.
Earlier, you announced a Latinx cluster hiring initiative to help Pitt increase the number of faculty focused on Latinx issues. For Pitt, how many make a cluster? And what's the status of that program?
That's a great question. What makes a cluster? We haven't decided exactly how many that's going to be. I would imagine it would be somewhere in the area of half a dozen to a dozen. But we are beginning with hiring a director of the Latin American Studies program at the senior level. And we are also beginning with a committee of mainly deans from different schools, but also some faculty, who are interested in this area and wish to bring in more faculty who are studying the Latinx experience. And that, I think, will then lead us to the next steps in terms of what areas, what schools, and how many positions we'll be able to invest in that.
Would they be incorporated throughout the schools, or would be maybe a separate center, a separate department, and therefore a specific curriculum?
Right. No, that's really key. We would like to bring diversity across the university, and we would also like to have a very interdisciplinary connection and collaboration for the Center for Latin American Studies and for the Latinx, the study of Latinx experience more generally.
For two straight years, the Wall Street Journal has named the University of Pittsburgh the best public university. But Pitt and Penn State also regularly are high up on the list of the costliest public universities in the nation. What are university officials doing to try to make Pitt more affordable while maintaining the quality of the academics?
Yeah, that is a very good point. So let me clarify that, first of all, it's our in-state tuition that is among the highest of in-state tuitions among public universities. Our out-of-state tuition is not as high compared to other public universities. But this is of great concern, I'm sure, to citizens of Pennsylvania, because both of our great in-state institutions are expensive. So we're doing a number of things. I mentioned before the Pitt Success Program, and that is a program aimed at Pell-eligible students in particular. And there, any student who receives a Pell grant, which is a federal grant for low-income students, will receive a dollar-for-dollar match from the University of Pittsburgh. So these grants go up to about $6,100. And this would mean that the students who would receive that would receive over $12,000 in grant funding. So that's the first probably biggest financial aid initiative.
How many students approximately would be eligible?
So we have about 2,200 students on the Pittsburgh campus who are Pell eligible, I believe. And then across all of the campuses, there would be another about 1,500 others.
So the match is for any University of Pittsburgh student, no matter what campus?
That's correct.
And that program started this semester, so just a couple of weeks ago?
That's correct. We just announced it at the end of February, and we have just been implementing it beginning this year. It has had a great effect on our ability to attract low-income students. We have added an additional 18% of low-income students in our incoming class. But what I think this shows is that if we can help our, you know, high-achieving but low-income students to actually afford a great Pitt education, then they will choose us. They will come. And so I'm very excited by the results so far. But we expect it to have even greater results as we go forward, both in our ability to recruit the low-income students, but also in their ability to stay at Pitt and to graduate on time.
In your most recent message posted to the Provost website, you asked students to complete a survey about college costs and how students are meeting those costs. What prompted the survey?
Actually, it really was the Pitt Success Program, as we talked about it. One of the things that we've talked about is what is typically called unmet need. So how do students find the funding to fill this gap between their family resources and what they can earn working over the summer or something like that, and the grants that they receive from the university and the loans that they can get? How do they fill the gap between that and the actual cost of attendance? We're very interested in finding out what students actually do. Do they skimp on rent? Do they skimp on food? Do they go out and get extra jobs? So are they working a lot of overtime? What is it that they're doing to fill that gap? Or are they just getting more unsecured student loans, which is also very problematic for their future, their long-term future?
So this information could lead to additional initiatives, possibly?
Yes, absolutely.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Ann Cudd, University of Pittsburgh Provost. And unionization has been a big issue on Pitt's campus. Year-long effort to organize Pitt faculty appeared to have failed this spring. State Labor Relations Board found that not enough faculty signed cards supporting unionization. You in the past have questioned the necessity of a faculty union in campus emails. What's your stance now?
Well, we're really in a holding situation right now because there are some appeals going forward regarding the number, the counts of faculty and the counts of cards. And really that's in the hands of a hearing board at this point.
Do you know if there's any timetable for a decision on that with the Labor Relations Board?
We believe that late fall or early winter, there may be a hearing on that.
And I believe there was a question about meeting the 30% threshold of number of faculty to sign it. And of course, union supporters said, well, you're counting adjunct faculty that haven't taught in years. So who was eligible to sign it?
That's correct. I think that the main issue that will be decided is who would count as a potential bargaining unit member and who wouldn't. And really, it's a rather complicated issue. And so it's something that has to be argued back and forth.
There was also another unionization effort of University of Pittsburgh graduate students. It was declared inconclusive, the balloting. At that time, there was a 37-vote margin against unionization, but there were 153 contested votes. Can you tell us what the status of that is?
Yeah, that's no longer inconclusive. In fact, it was ruled that that was the correct gap. And so the unionization effort was defeated, but then they've also appealed. So that's, again, also up to the hearing board to decide on some of those issues.
University of Pittsburgh Provost Ann Cudd is our guest on The Confluence. Pitt is entering the sixth in a series of themed academic years. You're calling this year the year of creativity. What does creativity in this context mean to you?
Wow. Creativity, I think, is the virtue that best describes what humans can do best. So I think we are creative when we think of new ideas, new ways of doing things, new ways of understanding each other, as well as new ways of creating art or music or whatever. So it cuts across everything we do. I was struck when I first came here in talking with Art Levine, our Senior Vice Chancellor for Health Sciences and the Dean of the Medical School, who is himself a very creative scientist. He always tells me that the way he looks for the most talented faculty is he looks for the most creative people. And it struck me that in the sciences, in the life sciences, creativity is just as important, if not, you know, as important as in any other field, as in art or music or philosophy.
Another priority that I heard of yours has been providing support for projects to personalize students' educational experiences. How are you making that time at Pitt almost tailored to meet the individual needs of students?
Right. So we find that students really want to be able to make choices, to develop their own path, if you will, to forge their own path through their education. And what we want to do is provide tools, and especially technologies, but also ways of advising, so that we can help them to find what's their best path. So, for example, suppose that they want to enter a health career, but they're not sure which one. There are a wide variety of health careers. And many of our students at the University of Pittsburgh, because that's such a strength for us, do want to enter into health careers. So we've developed a specific program of advising for the integrated health sciences, as they call it, so that students can see, oh, I want to be a public health specialist. Oh, maybe I want to be a nutritionist and that sort of thing. So we also not only try to help them figure out which is the best academic, you know, strictly curricular path, but also what experiences outside of the classroom would best prepare them and excite them about their futures. So internships, study abroad, research opportunities, and those sort of things. So that's really what's going into personalizing education is a really great set of advisors and some tools that can help them to forge their own path.
Ann Cutt is the provost of the University of Pittsburgh. Ann, thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you, Kevin. It's been a joy.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, Pittsburgh's police department says it wants more black officers. African Americans make up 25% of the city's population, but only 13% of its police force. Then we'll hear about a collection of art spanning the mid-19th century to today that celebrates all things that make Pittsburgh, well, Pittsburgh. And the Steelers open the regular season Sunday against New England. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Ariel Worthy. School is back in session. As students throughout the area started their fall semester, another group joined them. Juveniles charged as adults in Allegheny County Jail. About a dozen students are enrolled at the Academic Institute, a school tucked in Allegheny County Jail where they can work towards earning a diploma. Pennsylvania law requires jails and prisons to educate minors consistent with state standards. And activists who helped get Congressman Connor Lamb elected are split on his response to calls for President Donald Trump's impeachment. Lamb says he is not convinced that the bar has been met for impeachment. Find more top stories on our website at wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Rapper and Pittsburgh native Mac Miller died 1 year ago this week. His passing was later ruled an accidental overdose, and now investigators in Los Angeles say it was the result of counterfeit opioid pills laced with fentanyl. 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley covered much of the community response in the wake of Miller's death. She's with us now. Thanks for coming in, Katie.
Thanks, Kevin.
Mac Miller had a strong following, obviously, in Pittsburgh, but was collaborating with other rising stars across the country when he died in 2018. For those who aren't familiar with his work, what did Mac and his music mean to Pittsburgh?
Mac was a big deal here. He went to Taylor Alderdice High School. He was a Pittsburgh kid. He rapped about Pittsburgh. I mean, he has an album called Blue Slide Park, based off of the one in Frick Park. And people really looked up to him. A lot of aspiring artists here in Pittsburgh always, a lot of them point to Mac as being like, he inspired me to do my art.
Mm-hmm. What was it like here in the initial days after he died? And I know you covered that vigil at Blue Slide Park.
Yeah, people were shocked. People were really, really saddened by his death. I mean, he was only 26. And so they gathered at Blue Slide Park. It was tons of teenagers, a few actual adults. And then they were listening to his music. People were doing DJ sets. People were doing live art. There were some beautiful kind of artistic renderings of Mac that people were selling and people were showing off there.
So how is Pittsburgh marking the one-year anniversary of his death?
Well, there was a mural unveiling. I wouldn't say unveiling. They created this mural right next to the MLK mural, which is in Larimer.
Mm-hmm.
And Mac had actually, I was told by the guy that kind of runs that program, that Mac had actually contributed to that mural. So it made sense that a mural of Mac was right next to it. So it's this beautiful kind of yellow and white painted mural. And artists came up and they wrote, you know, there was one guy that said, say less, do more. And someone told me, Mac had told them that all the time, that, you know, that was his motto, say less, do more, show some action. So people are really affected by it and still thinking about him.
The family created a grant fund out of donations from a benefit concert. More than $935,000 were raised. One of the first recipients in after-school arts and music program. What made Hope Academy special?
So Hope Academy is this music and arts place in East Liberty, and they serve over 400 kids, and half of their tuition, it's very, you can go, and it's they make sure that it's for economically and socioeconomically disadvantaged students. So they are expanding their Suzuki program, which was previously just violin and cello, and they're going to add guitar and flute.
And they received a $50,000
Yeah.
So it was announced Tuesday, and of course the mural that you mentioned, but we're hearing that 28-year-old Cameron James Pettit appeared in court in Los Angeles this week, where a judge held him without bail. He's accused of providing Mac Miller the drugs that the rapper later overdosed on. Do we know anything else?
We just basically know that's it. He's being held right now and charged with not, you know, actual homicide or anything like that, just selling the drugs. This came from an Instagram post and some social media communication and some text between Mac and Cameron, and that's how police know that he's probably the guy that sold him the counterfeit drugs.
Katie Blackley is a reporter and producer at WESA. Katie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
Miller's family has declined comment on the arrest through a spokesman. According to the AP, Pettit is to return to court for arraignment October 10th, and a memorial for Mac is being held today from 4 to 7 at Blue Slide Park. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's Police Bureau says it wants more black officers. African Americans are underrepresented on the force. Some members of Pittsburgh's black community say the city could do more. 90.5 WESA's Ariel Worthy reports.
Reggie Island didn't grow up wanting to be a police officer. As a kid, he even felt racially profiled by police. He says his parents taught him that as a black man, he should be more careful interacting with cops.
Me growing up, my parents always told me to respect the cops, respect any type of authority figure, and just do what they say now so that you can be able to fight for it later.
But Island was interested in criminal justice and became a Pittsburgh cop after college. His partner was Calvin Hall, a black officer who was shot and killed while off duty in July. Island said he and Hall would talk frequently about the need for more black officers in Pittsburgh, and they wanted to patrol areas like Allegheny Dwellings.
These are all predominantly black areas, and to be able to patrol these areas, you should have somebody that's like the community in that community, patrolling that community. It just gives them more of a comfort.
Like many urban police departments, Pittsburgh has had a hard time recruiting black officers. Police statistics show that 13% of its officers are black. That's in a city where nearly a quarter of its population is African American.
Peace, brother.
Local activist Jasiri X says to get more black people to apply for police jobs, the department must earn their trust. Jasiri says that doing that would require getting rid of officers with a history of disciplinary problems.
If there are officers that are constantly involved in cases of brutality or even cases of domestic violence, those officers need to be removed.
City officials say they do fire officers for misconduct, but sometimes the police union gets them reinstated. Meanwhile, Police Chief Scott Schubert is using training to change the department's culture. He says the goal is to increase officers' quote, racial intelligence, and to teach them that how they feel can affect the way they do their job.
You know, if they come to work and they're upset and they're angry, they're going to go out on the street and potentially be angry. And that's not good for the community, that's not good for the officer, that's not good for the department.
Schubert says he believes the new training will build trust, which could help with hiring in the long run.
But I think if you build that trust in a community, I think you have more of an opportunity for people who, even if there's still some level of distrust, know that there's hope and they can be the change that they want to see.
This isn't just a local problem. Sonia Pruitt heads the National Black Police Association. She says her organization sees similar issues nationally. She says she thinks that Black people do like the police, but they don't like misconduct. She says if police are serious about their efforts, they may have to recruit from elsewhere.
You're going to have to take some trips or something. You know, maybe you can do some outreach and go to places where there are people who look like the people that you want to hire.
The city has gone to Howard University in Washington, D.C. to find Black recruits. It also uses social media for recruitments, and officers attend events in mostly Black Pittsburgh neighborhoods. Some Black Pittsburghers are getting the message. Dre Gordon is a recent graduate from Nazareth Prep in Emsworth. He says he got interested in becoming an officer after police visited his school. And a big reason he wants to join the force is the number of Black people dying at the hands of police.
That was one of the things that motivated me to say, like, yes, I want to be a police officer because I want to be in those situations. Because I feel like I can probably read those situations a little better.
Gordon said initially many of his family and friends didn't support his desire to become an officer. But after he explained why, they understood. Gordon said he thinks the police could get more Black officers if they went to more urban schools.
I don't think they reach out to like Pittsburgh public schools that well. I just think I got reached out because I went to a Catholic school.
A representative from Pittsburgh Public Schools said while they don't have recruitment fairs with the police, Westinghouse does offer a program for students who are interested in becoming emergency responders. The Westinghouse's student body is mostly Black, and the program had its first graduating class this year. So it's too soon to say if it will help turn hiring trends around. I'm Ariel Worthy, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Carnegie Museum of Art in Oakland is home to more than 32,000 pieces of art, ranging from ancient pottery to digital photos spanning some 3,000 years. Ceramics, paintings, and sculptures from around the globe are housed here. And now there's a new exhibit with a hometown focus. A Pittsburgh anthology recently opened at the museum, and WESA's arts and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll has a few can't-miss suggestions. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you doing, Kevin?
Bill, I understand the exhibit is sort of a celebration of Pittsburgh creativity over the years. How many years are we talking about?
Yeah, the earliest piece is a landscape painting from 1852. It's kind of this rustic scene, not necessarily what you would think of as Pittsburgh in the 19th century, but you know, it was a painting made here and goes all the way up to the current day, so it spans about 160, 170 years.
Rustic and Pittsburgh, not often used together.
Right.
At least recently. Are all the featured artists from Pittsburgh, though?
No, not all of them. It's just that many of them are. Some of them are actually working artists living in Pittsburgh today, people whose names listeners would know, like Thad Mosley and Vanessa German. But it's people who lived in Pittsburgh or maybe just made work about Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of the current working artists from there, what can we expect to see from Thad or Sharif or Vanessa?
Well, Sharif doesn't actually live here,
I don't
think, anymore. He was born here, and he has an earthenware sculpture in the show. Vanessa German is known for these sculptural figures she makes with found objects that are really fantastic. She finds the objects in her neighborhood of Homewood, and this is one of those pieces. It's called Toaster. It's actually built around a toaster. Thad Mosley makes these great sculptures mostly out of wood that he sources locally, actually, and he's still living and working here at age, I think he's 93 now.
Amazing.
He's incredible. And so those pieces are here. There's another artist named Lenka Clayton who does kind of these, I would call them sort of minimalist work. She makes like typewriter drawings with marks from a typewriter is one of the pieces she has in here. And there's work by, there's a lot of photography in the show, including kind of a suite of photos by Teenie Harris, the famous news photographer.
Right. Some exhibits are organized by medium or chronology, but this one is slightly different. How is this exhibit organized?
Well, it's just organized partly by the uniting theme is just that it's all about works about Pittsburgh. So there's even like maps and things, sort of artistic renderings of maps, stuff like that. There's photographs by the famous photographer Margaret Bourke White from the 50s that she made in Pittsburgh that give kind of a sense of what the city was like in those days. But it's something that the museum wanted to do. You know, these are works from their collection to give a sense of place, to create a sense of place about Pittsburgh and all the people that have lived here.
And it's like 14 sections, and there are narrative cards written, I understand.
Yeah, they're different sections, right. And they're not really, it's not thematic beyond Pittsburgh exactly, but the sections, each one has a different writer. Sometimes it's the artist, sometimes it's museum staff. In the case of the Teenie Harris photos, they were organized around the theme of home, and they were picked by teenagers from the museum's Youth Art Initiative. And the text was written by Sean Bove Buford, who works with the initiative. And it was these kids picked these images that Teenie had shot of Pittsburghers at home, African-American Pittsburghers from like the 50s and 60s.
Right. It's wonderful to get all those different folks involved.
Yeah.
The anthology touches on industry, pollution, part of Pittsburgh's history, obviously, and even Uber. What sort of overall story does it tell, would you say?
I think that Pittsburgh has a complicated story. You know, there's pieces in it that are actually industrial products that were made in Pittsburgh too, like a modernist red porcelain bathroom sink from 1930. You know, so it's a way of reflecting like a lot of the work that's going on here, all the different kinds of people who have lived here over the years, and I think by including a lot of work that documents African Americans and is by African American artists, it maybe broadens our sense of what Pittsburgh has been historically a little bit.
The industrial items, were the reasons given? Have you found out anything about why certain items were selected?
Only that they were made here, you know, made by companies here, were designed here. You know, there's a lot of industrial design is not a field that people think about a lot. It's what results in the material that we have around us, the objects that we have around us every day, but it's kind of invisible work. And highlighting it in a museum exhibition like this, as the Carnegie often does, is a way of saying, hey, think about the work that went into creating these objects that make up your everyday world.
Pittsburgh, I'm a native, so Pittsburgh is a city with a lot of hometown pride. Does the exhibit feel nostalgic? Does it lend a fresh perspective maybe to our city's narrative? Realizing you're not a native, although you've lived here a long time.
Yeah, I think, you know, and folks who are natives obviously are going to have different takes on it. I feel like it, a lot of the images depict Pittsburgh in the past. And some of them are these representational kind of documentary images, again, like the Teenie Harris photos, especially the Margaret Bourke White photos. But I don't think they're nostalgic. To me, they're just like, you know, they're giving you just a sense of what everyday life was like. To me, nostalgia is sort of romanticizing the past. Mm-hmm. And I don't think any of these images do that.
Art is often meant to generate a response, a reaction. Does this exhibit allow for some sort of interaction?
It does. Yeah, there's a response station, what the museum is calling a response station, where people can write their own stories about Pittsburgh, like, you know, what their experience here has been. And so it's interactive in that sense.
So, items, anything in this exhibit that you think will surprise visitors when they go? You've already mentioned the red bathroom sink. Anything else that might surprise visitors?
Well, again, I'll mention this sort of like industrial design thing, because, again, it's not something that everybody thinks of as art. There's this little fishbowl, they call it, a Ruba Rhombic fishbowl from 1928. Designed by Thomas W. McCreary for the Phoenix Glass Company. Again, just a little something that people might have had on like a coffee table or whatever in the 20s and 30s in their house. But again, something you don't necessarily think of as art, but is definitely part of the story of Pittsburgh's industrial past.
So long-term exhibit, how long was it going to be in place?
Supposed to go till early 2022, which is when the next Carnegie International, believe it or not, is scheduled for.
Oh,
so it's going to be up for quite a while, but they are going to rotate objects in. It won't be the same few dozen objects the whole time. They'll put in new stuff.
All right, Bill. So anything else in Pittsburgh's arts world we should look forward to this fall?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. This month, especially, City of Asylum's Jazz Poetry Month is starting. Mm-hmm. So that's events that run throughout September with visiting artists and musicians from all around the world, collaborating in many cases. Bricolage Productions' new immersive theater piece called Project Amelia is opening on September 20th. That should be really something. And then there's a new show at the Andy Warhol Museum coming in October called Andy Warhol Revelation. It's about his how his religious life informed his work, which is something that not a lot of people know about.
Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. As always, Bill, thanks so much.
Sure thing, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The 2019 NFL season is underway. Last night, the Green Bay Packers defeated the Chicago Bears 10-3. The Steelers kick off their regular season Sunday night on national television in Foxborough against the defending Super Bowl champs, the hated, feared New England Patriots. We welcome back to The Confluence Sean Gentile, senior writer for The Athletic. Hi, Sean.
Kevin, how are you?
I am well, sir. Sean, I see at least two reasons why Steeler fans are riled up. Maybe they're even angry going into Sunday night's game. First, the Steelers, as we know, failed to make the playoffs last season. And second, New England won their sixth Super Bowl, tying the Steelers for the most in history. What do you think? Is that enough to get the Steeler fans angry?
Did they need an excuse? No. I mean, really, but between that and the endless Antonio Brown drama and whatever, there are plenty of reasons to be angry here in week one, Kevin. It's September. It's still really hot outside, and there's no shortage.
Well, fortunately, that Antonio Brown drama is now out in Oakland,
oh, yeah,
where he could very well be suspended for a game, the first game as a Raider. So is it better to get New England early in the season or later? Doesn't matter, because after all, it's Tom Brady and Bill Belichick that you're going up against.
I think you'd rather have them early in the season. I think that's
fine.
I think that's something that New England has had happen, particularly over the last couple of years. Like they'll have the early kind of dud that makes its way into the September schedule, and also, I mean, you look at the Steelers playing New England in December and January. It hasn't worked out all that well. So I think it makes sense to try to get this one out of the way early for them,
especially late in the season in New England. But here's my caveat: they did beat New England in December, but it was at Steelers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So a little quiz. The Steelers have played New England a lot, and 17 times since 1998. That is a lot for a non-division rival. That includes playoff games as well. How many of those 17 have the Steelers won, do you know?
we were talking about this before, and I already forgot. I know that there's been one since 2004, right? It was against Matt Cassel.
You're right. So they've won five games.
Mm-hmm.
But four of those five were here in Pittsburgh.
Yep.
The one was in New England, and it wasn't even against Tom Brady. He was hurt at the time. I wonder, Sean, do you think they have sort of that little brother syndrome, I might call it, when it comes to beating Brady and the Patriots, especially on the road?
I think it's easy to say yes, but then you also have to ask yourself, like, how many other teams also have little brother syndrome against Tom Brady and the Patriots? They're really good. Generally, they beat everybody. So I think that's sort of the overarching thing when you talk about the Steelers' struggles against New England and in Foxborough specifically. That's a really hard place for everybody to play. But no, it is. I think it's human nature. You know, when you go up there consistently, and even if you talk about you know, in the Tomlin era, like you don't even have to stretch back to 2004. You can shorten the window a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, it has to enter their thinking a little bit. We saw that a couple years ago when Tomlin was very open, you know, saying we know we have to go through New England. We realize that's the sort of Damocles hang overhead. He knows it and they know it, and it's something they've acknowledged. So yeah, I think it's always in the back of their head. I don't think it's the main overarching reason for their struggles, but it's got to be part of it because they're human beings, and that's the nature of the game.
Yeah, longtime Steeler fans will remember the Houston Oilers. Now they're in Tennessee, that franchise, and Bum Phillips, their coach. Because Houston had that problem with the Steelers, and Bum would say, "We're going to kick that expletive door down with the Steelers." Do you see a similarity, Steelers, New England, and say the Penguins and the Washington Capitals? Well, before about 16 months ago,
I think so. I think that's a pretty good comparison to draw, because if you look at Caps Penguins, it was always something different. And I think that's sort of been the case with Steelers Patriots in one way. Like there's no like one smoking gun reason that they've lost these games, but they always find a way. Like if it's Tom Brady picking apart zone coverage, that was their big problem. It was a schematic thing for a while. They just didn't have the right group of players, you know, to pressure Brady, and they didn't have the right group of defensive backs to force him into tough decisions. That was a big thing. But then you look at the Jesse James game.
This is when he supposedly caught a touchdown, but it was ruled a fumble going into
they
the
changed,
end zone.
And they changed the nature of the fumble rule after that. There's been injuries. There have been headset malfunctions. Yes. There's been all sorts of stuff, and I think that's the shared DNA between Steelers, Patriots, and Caps, Penguins, is that it's always something, and it might be something different, and the variety of it is kind of impressive if you think about it. But they're always going to find a way.
All right. Well, the Caps got over their Steelers their Penguin nemesis. Let's see if the Steelers can do the same with New England in New England. So quickly, Sean, how do you rate the AFC Central Division? Cleveland's getting a lot of love.
Oh man, the pub that the Browns have gotten, it's wild to see. We're in a Twilight Zone scenario where the Browns are the trendy pick to win the division, which is funny because, you know, I think a lot of people here specifically because of the Browns' involvement and because it's the Steelers, you forget that Baltimore won the division last year, and you forget that they're returning Lamar Jackson, who, you know, once they plugged him in a quarterback, you know, their fortunes changed completely. So they're going to have a full year of that too. I think really the only non-contender in the group is Cincinnati. They're going to be one of the worst teams in the conference. But yeah, those three teams at the top. I mean, it's a coin flip.
Well, pick one. Come on.
I sincerely think that the Steelers are the best team in the division, and it wouldn't surprise me to see them go 11-5 or 12-4 now, especially. The schedule is also breaking their way. You have Andrew Luck retiring, which makes the Colts game a lot more winnable. It's easy to put 12 on the board for them, and I'm not going to believe the Browns are going to do it until they do it. So yeah, I'll go with Steelers at 11-5.
All right. So we have just about 30 seconds left. Give me a surprise team that'll make the playoffs, whether it's the AFC or the NFC. Who sort of piques your curiosity?
Man, that's it. That's a really good question. I think this is going to sound crazy, but I think the Jets could make a run in the AFC East. I think Sam Darnold, their rookie quarterback last year, showed a lot as a rookie. He took some lumps, but he stayed in there and you know, produced on a pretty big level. And they have Le'Veon Bell. They've added some weapons. I think there could be a wild card spot there for them.
Very good. Sean Gentile is a senior writer for The Athletic. Thanks so much, Sean.
Certainly.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.